Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. And good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Hope you had a good night's sleep. I hope you've got a good day planned. And hopefully you've already spent some time with the Lord, or maybe you're just getting ready to, getting that cup of coffee. Maybe the slippers are still on. Who knows? But I'm praying that you have a great day. Proverbs 10:8 says, "The wise in heart accept commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin." So it's my prayer. I am not a chattering fool this morning. Of course, that's my prayer almost every day. Today is Take Your Sons and Daughters to Work Day. Great day, I guess, to do that. For 25 years, the Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work program has apparently been inspirational to kids all over the world. It's designed to be more than just a career day. When a child shadows a parent, it's meant to help children discover their passions. And it also encourages kids to be truant, because I guess they're probably not going to school if they're going to work with their parents. So go figure that. We've got a great show. Ben Johnson's with us. He's already on our studio line, so I don't want to waste any more time. He's from the Acton Institute, a favorite guest of mine. And then John Malcolm is going to be with us as well. So it's going to be an action-packed hour. It is just about 6 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a very short break and talk to Ben Johnson. Good morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Ben Johnson is a regular guest from the Acton Institute. Always look forward to our conversations with Ben, and for good reasons. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Good to be with you as always.
Thank you so much for coming back on the program. I always get excited when you're going to be a guest because of your wisdom and humor and all of that. So let's talk about this very difficult subject. This is maybe not the easiest subject to talk about, but the trial of this little two-year-old Alfie Evans. Now, for some of our, maybe we can get a hybrid version. There's some that don't even know anything about the story. And there's others that have heard about it that may want an update.
Sure. Unfortunately, Alfie Evans is, he's still, thankfully, he's still clinging to life, but unfortunately, he's not receiving any medical help toward that goal. Alfie Evans is 23 months old. He's a little boy in England, in Liverpool. And he had shown some signs of developmental delay when he was very young. When he was 7 months old, he started having seizures, and he ended up on life support in Alderhay Hospital in Liverpool. He had gone back and forth. He would show signs where he was getting better, and then he was getting worse. Eventually, the doctors decided that he was not going to improve and that they were going to pull his ventilator, stop him from receiving any artificial nutrition or hydration, and they were going to let him, quote-unquote, die with dignity. Hmm. His parents, who are now 20 and 21 years old, respectively, decided they wanted to seek further treatment. The hospital sued in court so the court would not permit them to get any further medical treatment for their 23-month-old little boy. And the courts have all sided with the hospital. They've said that the parents should not be able to assist the child in any way, despite the fact that Pope Francis was actually personally involved. He offered, there's a hospital that the Vatican actually owns, Bambino Gesù, Baby Jesus Hospital in the Vatican, that would treat him for free. The Italian government gave him Italian citizenship and offered to pay for all of his medical care, either in the Vatican or at another hospital in Genoa, which offered free medical treatment for him. They wanted to try new and innovative treatments for this disease, which has not even been named or properly diagnosed yet. And three levels of court, as well as the most recent appeal yesterday, have all turned all of these offers down. So he's currently surviving without ventilator, breathing with just a wee bit of oxygen support, and that is all that he is receiving. But he's been breathing on his own for 2 days, And the latest, the child's father spoke this morning. He wants to take their child home, and hopefully the hospital will at least let him take them home. So that's what's happening. But what you essentially have is a national health care system which has decided for itself what is in the child's best interest. And instead of allowing the parents to pursue every avenue, like any good, loving parent would, to try and do anything that they could to keep their child alive, the courts have decided that not only will the national health care system not provide one iota more, one shred of help more than what it is, but it won't even let other people provide it for free.
Ben, how and why does the hospital have that kind of power?
It's a radical redefinition of the power of government, one that everyone across the world should be afraid of, whether it's a parent or someone else. You know, we've heard in the past of cases where the government can intervene if someone is denying medical treatment to their children. For example, there was a case several years ago where a Jehovah's Witness was not allowing a blood transfusion, and the court overruled the Jehovah's Witness to force the blood transfusion that would save the child's life. It's one thing in a case, and that certainly is controversial for people of faith, perhaps, but it's one thing when medical treatment is being denied. It's another thing where they're trying to seek life-saving treatment, and the government is denying the treatment. Essentially, what it comes down to is, under British law, the court, the parents are supposed to decide what happens. However, if the hospital decides that the parents have decided wrongly, and the national health care system thinks it knows better what is in the child's best interest, they can go to court, and the court will determine who has the child's best interests at play. What the court has decided is that the doctors, in their infinite wisdom, say that this child is suffering from a disease that they can't even diagnose, but they can diagnose it well enough to know he will never, ever improve from it.
Wow.
And since he will not improve from it, and he is suffering, any treatment that he would receive would only prolong his suffering, and in effect, they are threatening the parents by saying that they're torturing their own child by trying to save his life. Now, as soon as, and to give you an idea how Orwellian that is, not only did the national, essentially you have the government on two sides of the equation, you have the national healthcare system and, you know, the national court system ganging up on the parents, but then on top of that, they say that the parents are torturing the child. As soon as the order came down yesterday morning, or I think it was 9:17 local time on Monday evening, the first thing they did was remove nutrition and hydration. Hmm. So they were going to starve him to death.
All right. I'm just trying to get my blood pressure down here. It's so disturbing.
So that's what we're dealing with is you know, two wings of the government teaming up to act as parents of this child and to deny him the medical treatment that is being offered to him for free by other places.
Yeah,
I think it shows the dangerous role when government tries to aggregate to itself powers that belong only to the family.
Right.
I think it shows the danger of the national socialized healthcare system.
Yes.
And it shows to us the dangers when people begin to say that governments can only be run by experts and we don't allow the private sector to allow experts to disagree with one another.
Mm-hmm. What kind of precedence is this setting?
Well, unfortunately, the precedent's been set. You might remember there was another similar case, Charlie Gard, mm-hmm. not that long ago, where it was the exact same. Now, he had received a formal diagnosis of mitochondrial disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But the same precedent has been set that the government, if the government wishes to, essentially the government is the parent of last resort, that parental authority has very well attenuated limits, and that the government ultimately will step in and police those limits quite jealously.
Mm-hmm.
The government will decide whether or not it wishes to extend this treatment, which is a problem with any kind of socialized medicine system or national health care system. When the government is providing, obviously there's no incentive since people don't have to pay except through taxes. Then people flood the medical system, and then rationing follows. They decide who's going to get priority, and they decide that a 23-month-old with very few signs of any recovery is going to, he's no longer going to receive any treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So they decide that they're going to pull the plug, and the government wing, the judicial wing of the government, agrees with the medical wing of the government. So essentially what it gives is the idea that parents are in second place when it comes to the raising of their own children, and
wow.
government, through the allocation of resources, gets to determine who lives and who dies.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just say, for example, the hospital says, all right, we're pulling all support. We're going to basically stop hydration and food and everything else. Why don't they just let him go home? Aren't they spending more money keeping him there?
Precisely. And that's what his father was arguing just this morning. I was watching his press conference today. His father said essentially that when they pulled the plug, they assumed that he would die instantaneously. They thought that these machines were keeping Alfie alive.
Mm-hmm.
He has survived with very minimal support for 2 days now. So just a wee bit of support in terms of the oxygen entering his blood,
mm-hmm.
but that's it. And he said this morning he doesn't need intensive care. He doesn't need to be in a hospital. He can receive everything that he needs at home with us. So I think that there's no question when he's at home, not only would he receive oxygen, he would obviously receive proper nutrition and care, and he would receive all of the medical treatment that he can receive within that home. So I think that there's no doubt it's in his best interest now to be out of this socialized medical system at home with his family. And what does that say about the National Health Care Service, where a young child has a better chance of surviving at home with his parents with very minimal care, and he faces certain death within the national healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very difficult, Ben. Let me take a break. I'm speaking to Ben Johnson. He's the senior editor at the Acton Institute. It's 17 minutes after the hour. When we return, more with Ben. Good morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Ben Johnson is my guest. He's senior editor of the Acton Institute. And that was a difficult conversation we had, Ben. But let me ask you about an article you wrote about outsourcing everything to the government. So people think, well, if I can get everything I need from the government, then why would I need to go to supernatural entities?
Yes. Well, there was a study that was done, published just about 2 weeks ago, in a well-regarded psychological journal, the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. Two researchers from the University of Rochester and one from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. And essentially what they did was measure the amount of government spending, how much each government in the world, as well as each of the 50 states, spend on health care and education as a percentage of GDP. And then they measured what they called religiosity across all of those. Religiosity is belief in God, church attendance, and the statement that religion is very important to yourself, the way you order your life. They found that when government spends more money, a greater percentage of its GDP on healthcare and education, that religiosity declines. So in other words, the bigger government, the fewer people have faith, the less people believe in God, and the more they rely on government. So they looked at this as an incredibly positive development. And one of the things that they found was that as government increases, they would find that religiosity decreases approximately 2 years later, formal religiosity. And their conclusion, and this is a quotation from the study, quote, "The power and order emanating from God can be outsourced to the government," end quote.
Wow. Oh, boy.
No, I don't know where the internal sin revenue system is, how I get
right.
My sins forgiven from Washington. I have a feeling with the way that works, I'd probably end up in worse shape than I was when I went in. But no, in all seriousness, their idea is that the only religion, and I tied this in the article, which is on blog.acton.org, back to Bertrand Russell and to a degree Sigmund Freud.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of well-regarded social scientist belief from philosophers and psychologists is that God is a construct. We invented him because we were afraid. Cavemen were afraid of the noises that they heard from the cave at night.
Mm-hmm.
Or when they were growing up, in the case of Sigmund Freud, we had a father watching over us. And when we get afraid, we project that image of a cosmic heavenly father into the heavens, and he watches over us. And so that's how we invented God, because we were afraid of the world around us, and we wanted someone to watch over us. So it's a crutch for weak-minded people like you, me, and all of your listeners.
Sure.
And I'm happy to be that weak-minded.
Me too.
I am proud to preach only my weakness and Christ's strength in that regard. But these researchers said, when the government provides things that people need, then people no longer rely on this cosmic figure they've invented. And I argue in the article they've got it exactly backwards. It's not the case that government gets bigger and then religiosity decreases. It's the other way around. We know through our Christian lives that religion is a progressive thing. We're taught that God exists. We believe in Jesus Christ as our Savior. And then from there, we start to apply that to the world around us. We see God's image in other people, and then we start to serve them. Then we care for the poor and open soup kitchens or provide portions of our income to the poor through charity because of what we see there. That's the final stage.
Mm-hmm.
When our faith dies, it dies in reverse. It's the behavior that goes first.
Right.
And so it's always a question of, why should I take up my cross and deny myself and follow him? Why should I give up my income to the poor? Sure, I still believe in God, but I don't really want to do that. And eventually the number of things I want to do dwindles to the point that I don't formally go to church. And then finally I say, I don't really even believe. That's
wow.
The last thing. But the more that we give up our faith, the larger government becomes. It's the opposite direction.
Well, Ben, we have certainly gotten to a point where if government gets bigger, people are going to their memories will fade of what it was like when you hit hard times and you were part of a church family in a community, and that church family took care of you and nurtured everything about your life, your physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. And if Big Daddy government comes in, then what?
Yeah, well, Alexis de Tocqueville was so surprised when he toured the United States of what he called voluntary associations or voluntary societies, the way that Americans helped one another in the societies that we belong to. You know, they multiplied. They were all over the place. There was a history book which went through the hundreds upon hundreds of voluntary aid societies where people helped one another, neighbors helped neighbors, families helped families, and churches particularly are the one institution that God has commanded should be involved in helping one another. So this is something that I think extends well beyond not just within the church walls, but outside them. You know, there was a Roman emperor named Julian the Apostate. After Constantine legalized Christianity in 313 AD, he actually tried to turn the clock back and reinstitute paganism, hence his name, the Apostate. And he found that the pagans didn't want to give charity to anyone. So he gave government money to the pagan church that he had established in order to dole this out. But he wrote a letter that went with it. And he wrote, and this is a quote, "It's disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans..." That's Christians. "The impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that people lack aid from us." So when it comes down to it, if we don't have a religion that teaches that we are created in the image of God the way that our biblically revealed religion does, where we believe that we're created in imago Dei, we have the spark of divine life within each and every life, and so we should care for it, that everyone is someone that Jesus has died for. If we don't have that biblically revealed truth in the heart of what we do, then we don't really have any incentive to give to others.
Mm-hmm.
Then selfishness becomes our prerequisite.
Mm-hmm.
And when you outsource it to the government, like you said, Big Daddy government, to tie this into that other more difficult conversation we just had about Alfie Evans, we should find out that government is never going to love us the way that our parents love us.
No, that's so true. And I'm sure government could create a tax structure for forgiving sins.
I would be petrified to find out where I would come out on that ledger.
I wouldn't have any money left whatsoever. I'd be in big debt. All right. Curious, Ben, what book is on your nightstand?
Well, right now I'm reading through a book called Vox Populi, which is a collection of essays on populism published by the New Criterion magazine, which was very good. And then I'm also reading Roger Scruton's new book, which is just fascinating. I've only just cracked the cover of that one, but I'm looking forward to devouring that in my earliest opportunity. It's called Where We Are, Roger Scruton, British philosopher. And he's always good not only at giving us the mall map image of where we are, but also where we should be going.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, just to close up our conversation and get back to Elfie for a minute, to think that Elfie's mom is named Kate, and then the Kate is giving birth to the royal baby with how many doctors giving them whatever they want in the same town.
Yeah, well, and that's a point that I make in the article at blog.acta.org is that when we look at these two cases, you have two people who are in the hospital the same day.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a national healthcare system that rewards that hands out material benefits, when the government is deciding who receives those benefits or who gets medical care, it's always the well-connected people who are going to receive it. Nobody believes that if the new little baby, and I don't think the baby's been named yet. Because in England, the Queen has to approve the name, and there's a whole process of history, and it's kind of a production to name a new heir to the throne. But this little baby is fifth in heir to the throne, this little boy, whatever he will be named. If that child, heaven forbid, were to be in that same situation as Alfie, does anyone honestly believe the NHS would say, no, you're not going to, and we will sue you in the court of law?
Right.
Prevent you from receiving this care?
Right.
Of course not. It's only the common people who suffer under this program. It's the well-connected who are always the ones who come out on top.
Yeah. So interesting, Ben. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. I look forward to our next conversation. Our listeners just love you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I love you, and God bless.
God bless you. Thanks. It's 28 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break. Back in a minute. It is half past the hour. Thank you to Ben Johnson. If you want to hear his analysis, once again, go to myfaithradio.com. Early morning, late show. It'll take you right to that interview. You can pass it on to a friend or listen to it again. John Malcolm is coming up next in about 10 minutes. He is from the Heritage Foundation, director of the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He's very smart. We'll talk to him about the Supreme Court arguments. Which started yesterday regarding President Trump's administration's travel ban. Be back in a minute. There we go. I just had to wait for the horns. We have to shorten that so the horns come in sooner. Yeah. Love that. All right. It is 25 minutes until the top of the hour. I've always said that you really don't know who you are until you know who you are in Christ. So maybe you struggle with being confident of who you are in Christ. Let's listen to this encouragement from Lauren DeMoss.
I would say confidence comes from your Creator and knowing who and whose you are in Christ. And it does. But we were made in His image for His purpose. And perfectly by His hand, but even more than that, really, real confidence comes from doing what's right and being right with God, having peace that you're doing and obeying all that He has laid out for you to do. And sometimes in life, that's more confusing than other times, but that's always the goal, complete surrender and obedience. And nothing beats that. No morning mantra, no follower count, no man or woman on this earth to shower you with love or gifts every day. Nothing beats the confidence from knowing exactly where you stand with God, because God wants us to have peace, and He wants us to have joy, and He wants us to have success in serving the kingdom.
If you want to hear more about that interview, go to myfaithradio.com, type in Lauren DeMoss. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Mr. John Malcolm is with us.
It's said much of today's liberalism is the epitome of a closed mind. This is Jim Garlow. In my opinion, much of the debate isn't about ideas. It's about power. A power that shuts down someone else's ideas if there's the slightest deviation from their definition of tolerance. Kim Holmes, a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation, calls it the closing of the liberal mind in his new book by that same title. If there's no open sharing of ideas in our colleges and universities, and certainly in our churches, what are we left with? Kim Holmes says, what we have is nothing less than intolerance championed in the name of tolerance, closed-mindedness in the name of open-mindedness, and hatred in the name of compassion. It's doublethink, and the deception is precisely the danger. What does the scripture say? Wolves in sheep's clothing. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Minutes until the top of the hour, John Malcolm oversees the Heritage Foundation's work to increase the understanding of the Constitution and the rule of law. He's the director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, a guest that I always, not only am I excited to have on the show, but I'm always a little intimidated by, and I don't know why, because he's such a nice man. Good morning, John.
Yeah, no need for that. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you're getting the Above and Beyond Award this morning, because I know you're catching a plane this morning. So thank you for taking the time to do this. Very interested to hear about the Supreme Court arguments regarding President Trump's administrative travel ban.
Yeah, no, it was quite a day at the court yesterday. There were tons of protesters, of course, outside.
Mm-hmm.
Several celebrities were inside. You had politicians. You had Senators Orrin Hatch and Mazie Hirono and Representative Bob Goodlatte. And there was, in fact, a celebrity, Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Was there. And you had two very skilled advocates on behalf of Hawaii and the challengers. You had Neil Katyal, who's the former acting Solicitor General. The current Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, was there on behalf of the government. And obviously the justices were paying full attention and asking a lot of tough questions. So, you know, the questions involved the legality and constitutionality of the president's third iteration of the travel ban that he issued last September. And the challengers have essentially two arguments. The first is that the president exceeded his authority under the Immigration and Nationality Act by issuing a ban, which is something that Congress, according to the challengers, had previously considered and rejected, so that he was supplanting, if you will, the rest of the provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act by this action. The other argument they have is that the proclamation was premised on the need for national security, but they argue that this was a pretext and that really this violates the Establishment Clause because it disfavors Muslims, and what was really the motivating factor for this was an anti-Muslim bias, and the evidence for that are some statements and tweets that the president made and some of his surrogates on the campaign trail, and then some statements that he has made after he was elected. So the argument essentially is, by the challengers, that the Immigration and Nationality Act clearly says that you cannot deny people the issuance of a waiver based on discrimination based on nationality. He looks at other provisions of the act and says that the Congress said that if you're a state sponsor of terrorism, you can't be admitted. There are certain discrete categories. And that other than that, they offered carrots in the form of visa waivers and expedited consideration to try to get countries to cooperate with us. But they didn't impose sticks in the sense of a penalty in the form of a travel ban, and that by doing this, the president has exceeded his authority.
Hmm.
Noel Francisco, responding to that, says, well, there's this other provision in the act that says that if the president can deny the admittance of any alien or any class of aliens if he believes that not doing so would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, could pose a danger. And he said that this doesn't supplant the Immigration and Nationality Act. It gives him another authority, a sort of a fallback to take advantage of situations like this one where new and intelligence comes to his attention, which is something that Congress could never have considered. Katyal, in response, says that if that provision were to be read so broadly, it could literally swallow the rest of the Immigration and Nationality Act. On the constitutional issue, so Katyal points to all of these statements – And he says that there were very, very flimsy premises offered in the proclamation itself as to why these seven countries, five of the majority Muslim countries, are on the list. He points that of the seven countries, that over well over 90% of the people residing in those countries are Muslims, so they're the most impacted by this. And he said that even if you ignored the campaign statements, that the president has rekindled, that was his word, rekindled mm-hmm. those sentiments through tweets and statements he's made after the election. The government, on the other side, says no, that this is all, that this is premised on national security. The proclamation laid out the neutral principles that were applied by the Department of Homeland Security, other agencies, to evaluate countries as to whether they really provided us what he referred to as minimum baseline information that we need to decide who to safely admit to our shores. He said that the things that the commonalities that these countries have is that they're either state sponsors of terrorism, they're safe havens for terrorism, they either don't cooperate less with us like Iran and North Korea and Venezuela, or in the case of places like Libya and Somalia, they just lack the capacity to cooperate with us. They're governments that are barely hanging on. And probably the most memorable line, in my opinion, is he said, look, this is not a Muslim ban, but if it was a Muslim ban, it is certainly the most ineffective Muslim ban that one could have thought of, because there are, after all, 50 majority Muslim countries, and this only covers five of them with approximately 8% of the world's Muslim population.
Wow. So, John, how would we have a constructive conversation about the information that the President of the United States has that no one else has?
Well, that's a very good point, and that's a lot of what the concern by the justices is. So in other cases, they have said that really national security decisions should be made by the political branches, specifically Congress and the President, and the judges are ill-equipped to make national security decisions. In a case that was discussed a lot yesterday, Kleindienst versus Mandel, the court had previously said that so long as the president offers a facially legitimate bona fide reason for an exclusion, the court should not peek behind that. So Justice Kagan asked Noel Francisco a somewhat strange hypothetical to try to get at this point. She said, what if we had a future, she called him an out-of-the-box president, who was a vehement anti-Semite, who made all kinds of disparaging statements against Jews during the campaign and after being elected, and he goes to his cabinet and he instructs them. He says, I want you to come up with a proclamation that dots all the I's and crosses all the T's, that just keeps out people from Israel. Could we look behind that order? And Noel Francisco said, in those limited circumstances, you could. He said that there were certain safeguards already in place. The other cabinet members have taken an oath to defend the Constitution. So if they receive such a blatantly unconstitutional order, they should either ignore it or resign. But that, you know, if they didn't, that a court could say, there is nothing to suggest that Israel, which is one of our closest allies, poses a threat to us. This does not appear to be facially legitimate, and then we can look behind it. He did add, though, that if once you look behind it, it was clear that there was a national security interest in keeping people out from Israel, that then it would be constitutional, even if what personally motivated the president was animus towards Jews.
Mm-hmm. John, what should we be understanding about this case? What, you know, when we start gathering around the old coffee maker at work, what should we understand as we engage in our conversations with others?
Well, there are a lot of important principles at stake. One is immediate, and the other is more long term, I think. So the more immediate concern is this is an important issue for our time. We face threats from abroad. You'd have to wink at reality if you didn't look at what's happening in Europe in terms of people who have come in as refugees and who have become terrorists, and that, you know, we need to know whether or not we're going to be able to do this extreme vetting or whether judges are going to override that decision. So there's an immediate national security concern. The long-term concern, which is equally important, if not more important in my mind, is that this is a real separation of powers issue, not only between the division of responsibility for national security and immigration between Congress and the president, but when are we going to allow judges to second-guess those decisions? Presidents receive daily classified briefings. Leaders of Congress receive periodic classified briefings. judges never receive classified briefings. When are we going to allow judges to peek behind the curtain, if you will, mm-hmm. and second-guess national security decisions, and what process are they going to use to do so?
Yeah. All right, John, I know we've got just a couple minutes left before we have to let you go, but I'm curious about getting your take on the Supreme Court case on internet sales tax.
Oh, my. All right, the Wayfarer case.
Yes, yes.
All right, so switching gears.
We are switching gears.
Yeah, so South Dakota has challenged a Supreme Court precedent. They've asked the court to overturn it. That was the Quill case. It was issued several years ago, in which the Supreme Court said, you know, look, unless a company has a bricks-and-mortar presence in your state, if you are an out-of-state retailer, because of the implications of interstate commerce, you cannot be compelled, that out-of-state retailer cannot be compelled to collect sales tax for a purchase made by somebody in your state. A few years ago, Justice Kennedy, in opinion, said, gee, in a modern internet age with all of these software developments, maybe this no longer makes sense, and maybe we should question that. And South Dakota, with, you know, its bricks and mortar businesses saying we need, you know, we're being unfair competition, and South Dakota saying we need the tax base, they passed a law designed to bring such a challenge. So they went into the lower court and they said, we lose, please dismiss our case so that we can appeal this to the Supreme Court so the Supreme Court can consider this. It's a very clever law in that they only required out-of-state retailers who sold over a certain amount, either in terms of number of units or dollar value of sales, to collect sales tax. And they took that case to the Supreme Court. It was, I think, the justices struggled during that argument, saying, you know, gee, why would we reverse Quill? Won't this pose a problem? I mean, this particular law says only dollar amounts over a certain amount or a certain number of transactions, but some state may come along in the future and say, no, any sale would require you to collect sales tax. Won't that hurt mom-and-pop operations out of state? Won't that be unworkable and expensive? And why shouldn't we leave this to Congress to fix this mess? Congress could, after all, pass a statute at any time that affects interstate commerce and say, now you need to collect out-of-state sales taxes, which before you didn't. Mm-hmm. There have been internet sales tax proposals bandied about in Congress for the last several years. So I'm not sure how that one is going to come out at all. I'm also, of course, not sure how the travel ban case will come out, although I got the impression that the majority of justices, perhaps a bare majority, were leaning the administration's way.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. I love having you on the program. You can come on anytime, or if you prefer, you can just have my job.
Well, I've got a pretty good day job, but I'm happy to join you anytime.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah. That's John Malcolm, my guest. We'll take a short break and be back with in just a minute. Thanks to John Malcolm and Ben Johnson. Those are two pretty smart guys. Rebecca, I don't. John Malcolm's got to dumb it down for me. I'm serious.
I think he's at least had his coffee. I think he had to catch an early morning flight today. So
yeah, he had to cut out a little bit early, but such smart analysis.
You got to get up pretty early in the morning to be John Malcolm.
Yeah, and you have to listen carefully. And I did listen carefully, and I still don't know if I got it all. So I may have to go back and listen to it again.
Well, fortunately, we have the podcast at myfaithradio.com. Little plug.
And how do you get that podcast?
You could just go to the website and check out our program page. Pretty easy there. You can play it directly from the page. You can download it. Or you could just download the app, and that's way more efficient.
Yeah.
Probably you could stream it there, sign up or through iTunes, if you're whatever your podcasting vehicle of choice is, we should be there.
So it is Take Your Sons and Daughters to Work Day. I guess that's designed to be more than just a career day where a child shadows a parent, and it's meant to help children discover their passions. There's a little boy in the neighborhood and that sent out a mass email, which it was adorable. And he's not waiting around to be, for mom or dad to inspire. He's deciding that he's going to do something about it. He said, my name is Sam and I'm 10. I'm a kid that wants a dog but can't have one because people in my family have allergies. So if you want your dog walk, just email me. I charge $1 per walk, no matter how long you want me to walk them.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That's so cute.
I'm not sure that's a great business decision. And he just wants to be with a dog.
I know. All right. In California, big surprise here, a California marijuana dispensary has rolled out a never-before-used option for smokers to get their product. It's a vending machine. What possibly could go wrong?
They don't take exact change. For starters, there's one problem.
So,
oh my goodness, it's a different world, isn't it?
There's craziness on one coast. Now let's just take a cross-country trip to the other coast.
Oh, let's.
And there's a ban in Massachusetts, a preschool, that says they've banned the use of the term best friend. Yeah.
Why, pray tell?
Because it's exclusionary. That's why.
Oh, so everybody has to be your friend. You can't have one best friend because it would make the other people feel bad?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. It's up to parents and teachers to help children learn the skills they need to make friends, including what to say when they want to join a game. Now, you're going to love this part. It says that you can role play with puppets so kids can pick up confidence. If I'm playing with puppets, it's not helping my confidence.
I was going to say, maybe the puppet is the best friend. Oh, I mean, sure, you want everybody to kind of feel generally liked, accepted, not excluded. But at the same time, I mean, is that reality? Are we training kids that they no longer have to just kind of play within the bounds of reality and that we can just make whatever world? You would think that that would be a rude awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be even harder for them to accept, especially if they're trying to go through life at like 18 and 20, explaining their situation with puppets.
Right. All right. If you're trying to figure out what to do this summer for a little vacation with the family, I'm just throwing this out as an option. Pizza Hut opened the Pizza Hut Museum in Kansas. There you go. It's a new museum dedicated to a national pizza chain. And so I guess you can go to a pizza museum. So if you don't know if you want to do the Black Hills or Mount Rushmore, maybe just the pizza museum.
That seems like it's worth the drive, honestly.
Yeah. And it's my brother Scott's birthday today. Happy birthday, Scott, even though you're probably not listening. And it's also Carol Burnett's birthday. She's 85. And, you know, Paul and I were talking about when censorship was in place, it seems that the writers and the performers had to work within tighter structures, and they produced more clever material.
Boundaries are good for creativity.
Yes, indeed they are. So I just remember how hard I used to laugh watching Harvey Korman and Tim Conway crack each other up. And Tim Conway would do everything in his power not to break up. And it was just like a volcano getting ready to erupt. So fun to watch. That's when comedy was lots and lots of fun. We'll take a little break and wrap up Hour 1. Thanks for being with us. Thanks again to John Malcolm, Ben Johnson. What a great hour. A little bit on the heady side, but, you know, I think we all survived. I know I did. I think my IQ went up about 0.006% as a result of their guests being on my show. Now, next up, Dr. Peter Kaftner is going to come in, and then John Bloom will be in studio for the Mick Arnold Group. So looking forward to that. Be back with Hour 2 in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.